As I've been discussing with our voice from America, Bruce Shapiro, recently, the midterm elections are looming with some very fraught and fascinating contests. A lot of speculation that the Democrats might be able to win back some of what is now called Trump country. Trump country. Our next guest doesn't like the term. It's been used to describe the state she comes from, Kansas. And I note with interest that she points out that 40% of the locals voted for Hillary. Sarah Smarsh is the daughter of fifth-generation Kansas farmers who were them. And she was the first in her family to go to college. She became a journalist who covers issues of class and inequality. And she always brings her own experiences of poverty to her writing. Now she's the author of a fascinating family history called Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. And Sarah joins us on the line from her home in Wichita. Welcome to our little wireless program, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Philip.
Your memoir looks at the history of the family. Some are fifth-generation farmers, others worked in cities, but despite all sorts of hard yakka, as we call it in Australia, they never had much money. Tell us a bit about growing up in Wichita in the 1980s.
Sure. Well, most of my upbringing was on a wheat and cattle farm about 30 miles west of Wichita. And just for your listeners, Wichita is the largest city in Kansas, which is a overwhelmingly rural state. Wichita has about maybe 400,000 people nowadays. So it's a relatively small city in the context of urban America. But I had proximity to it. That 30 miles did require gas money, but enough of my upbringing kind of intersected with Wichita that I had a bit of a rural urban vantage. And so my family, I was born into what we now I think rightfully call the working poor. My dad is a lifelong construction worker and also used to farm, as most of the people in my family did. The demise of the family farms in my country that has been a story for decades due to industrialized and corporatized agriculture was really coming to a head when I was a child. So the economic despair that we talk about now when we discuss small town or rural America was all around me and kind of the context of my upbringing.
I should point out to the listener that you were born in 1980 at the beginning of the Reagan era. Good timing.
That's right. Or as a writing professor once told me, bad for life, good for writing.
So let's just look at a bit more of the family history. Your mother was only 17 when you were born, and your dad's carpentry business went bust. So there were a few sad stories right at the outset.
That's right. And the class that we are native to was hit particularly hard by the administration you just cited, who my mother actually voted for the incumbent Democratic President Jimmy Carter when she was a teenager with a three-year-old infant. That was me. And just like today when you were referencing the kind of large majority that gets rendered invisible when we talk about red states here in this country, or blue ones for that matter, she was on the losing end of a political tide and shift to the right in our state. When I was researching my book Heartland, I found over and over that so many statistics that often correlate with the sad tales that you were just citing indicate a real intertwinement between the private stories that we were living as a family and the public forces that were happening in that decade.
Let's look at some of the advice that you got from mum and grandmother. Don't be a teenage mother. Your mother was quite cold and resentful of the fact that she was a teenage mum. Mm.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned my legacy of farming. I grew up helping farm the same land that my ancestors drove across with wagons, and so that is really a legacy of my paternal side. On my maternal side, when you were referencing people who worked in cities, and the women of my family and my maternal line specifically worked in factories, and they were waitresses in truck stop diners, and not so much a farming lot, but the legacy into which I was born, or the challenging cycle into which I was born on that side of my family. is the teen pregnancy. So best I can find in my research, I am the first female from that direct maternal line to not have a child as a teenager. And I was keenly aware of that. I didn't have the language or big picture understanding to articulate why it somehow had something to do with poverty, but I sensed it at an almost cellular level. And certainly my mother is an example of what is true for so many young women all around the world, that their life outcomes often are determined by early pregnancies.
There are many parallels between your childhood and mine. I was raised on a very small, dirt-poor farm, and my mother, unlike my father and grandparents, was, had city jobs. Your grandmother got a state job in the courthouse, which gave her a stable income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really one of, I loved how you described my book in your lovely introduction as, I think, a family tale, because even though it says memoir on the cover, much of the personal narratives and the family sagas are constructed from years of interviews I did with family members about events for which I was not even present or born yet. And one piece of that puzzle, and one reason that I'm always reverent to my family, and in particular the sacrifices of women along the way, is that Grandma Betty, she who is one of the kind of the stars of the book, in the 1970s, after essentially being barred from the workforce in just about every sphere, of course she was working all along, but you know, she could access a job in a factory or waiting tables in a diner, but she couldn't access jobs where she didn't have to be objectified or break her back in manual labor. Finally, here in this country, we had a legislation called Title IX that provided for federal grants that would allow women like my grandmother, who left school in ninth grade at age 14 or 15 to work, to gain professional training to enter the workforce and be protected, at least in theory, for their gender in those spaces. And as soon as she had the opportunity, she went to what they called business school. She learned how to type, how to file things for an office, and she landed a gig in the courthouse in downtown Wichita. And that was really she was the first person in our family, perhaps for centuries, really, and for certainly a woman, who had the opportunity to work in a space where she didn't leave at the end of the day just totally physically busted and filthy. She had, you know, clearance, cheap high heels from the mall or something, yeah. And she got to walk across a clean lobby to her 9-to-5 job. And for me as a kid, that was just the most glamorous thing I had ever seen.
Sarah, you point out that you were the only person in your family who didn't have a violent or abusive father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that, you know, when you're living it in real time, you can't quite put your finger on what's different about one's own household from other nuclear households. But as I thought about the book and constructed this family story, I saw, okay, well, I had some more positive outcomes than some in my family. And I bet it's not a coincidence that that I had a gentle and kind, even poetic father who, yes, is a construction worker and probably a vision of what some U.S. media outlets hold up as a vision of the hateful Trump voter or something, and he couldn't be further from that. And not to suggest that requires a violence, but he is a very gentle soul, and that you know, was a real blessing to me that my mother, whereas Betty broke that that cycle of women having jobs that were either physically laborious or objectifying, my mother then sort of broke the cycle of picking a mate who would be violent toward the female and the children.
Sarah, tell me about Grandpa Arnie. I came to be very fond of him in the book.
I'm glad to hear that because I, as you know from the book, was fond of him myself. He was not my biological grandfather, but the grandpa I always knew. And so he would also be put in this category with a kind and gentle working class guy. My grandmother Betty's earlier husbands were not in that category. But by the time I came along, she had sort of settled down, fallen in love with a farmer, and was on this for the first time in her life, a stable space where she didn't have to fear for her physical safety, and it was a loving place full of humor, hard times for certain, and a lot of hard work. But it was overall a very nurturing environment, and my grandfather Arnie was at the helm of that as the farmer, and he, like my dad, was born into essentially German Catholic wheat farmers, which is a major contingent of the rural Kansas population. And he left school in sixth grade. He, you know, it's very unlikely that I'm an author in the coming out of the family that I do. It's not a bookish lot, but that's not for lack of intellect or intelligence. It's really just for lack of access to education. And so he and I had very different lives, but we're kind of kindred spirits in some ways.
There's a lovely bit where you're massaging Arnie's neck. And, of course, it's weather-beaten and red. Mm-hmm. Now, this is hence the term redneck. My grandfather, also a farmer, had a very red neck as well. It makes a dramatic contrast to the blue collar and the white collar, doesn't it?
Yes, well said. Yeah, that term is one that has always been, you know, has kind of stuck in my side as something that is usually a pejorative or levied as an insult. And understanding that I come from that population, I wanted to explore what the meaning of that word was, and I usually don't care for its usage, but my grandfather had the physical mark of it in a very literal way, and there was some poetry in that, I think.
I remember when my grandfather would try and get the chip heater going for hot water for a shower, that I'd glimpse him, the redneck contrasting with the shock white of his body. That's also a characteristic of the redneck.
Yes. Yes. And I don't know if you all have this term, but we say farmer's tan. And that is when a man is, like my father and most of the men I know, just dark from the neck up and from about where a t-shirt hits on the sleeve down to the wrist. But if you know, take the shirt off, he's then white from the middle of his bicep through the torso. And so we call that a farmer's tan. And it's just one of many ways that that class really kind of leaves a physical mark on the body.
Sarah, it's interesting that your family described themselves as middle class. You always had food on the table, but you knew your family was poor, even compared to others around you in Wichita.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, something that that I find fascinating and frustrating about my home country is that our language for discussing class is so utterly inadequate, and often points not just to a lack of understanding, but perhaps even a willful denial of the class structure that certainly shapes this place. And so with that denial comes a lack of understanding sometimes of one's own experience. And by that I mean, if we're operating under this guise of being a meritocracy, we haven't been, at least for centuries, directly talking about class. That's shifting now to some extent. And then, by extension, one doesn't have a language for understanding or articulating one's own class residency. So for my family, we on the one hand felt like, well, we've got enough to eat and we have a roof over our heads and therefore no complaints. And if someone would have asked us, I suppose we probably would have said middle class roughly. I never in a million years would have used the word poor. And yet I did understand, as you said, within the context of my own community, I was always on the bottom rung of the socioeconomic pecking order. So there's all kinds of twists and turns that I think that we do psychologically to keep these sort of systems in place.
Talking about matters psychological, where the hell did you get the confidence to think that you could have a different life, that you might be able to make a living not with physical labor, but with your mind?
I love the pointed question, and I think it's an important one. I, of course, can't answer the why, but I do know that the boldness that I had as a child, you know, I think often we paint poverty as this miserable lot, and actually there is a courage and a defiance that is required of anyone who is surviving in that context. It just often goes unsung. And so that aspect of my personality was just really my birthright, and it is the same story among many members of my family, that they have a pride and a confidence about them that is essential for survival. I channeled that into the goals that I did. It was probably a combination of I had a bookish disposition. I benefited greatly from the historically excellent public school system in Kansas, which has been under attack by state administrations for about a decade. But for me as a child in the 80s and a teenager in the 90s, it certainly did right by me. And just in that 17 or 18 years between me and my mom, there was probably a shift in attitudes toward female students. My mom was extremely precocious and bold and intelligent and really had the language of an intellectual somehow just by way of reading. She, as a kid in the 60s, a female, would not have been encouraged in the same way that I did. So these are the best guesses that I can give you for answering that complicated question.
Well, I should tell the listener that you went to 21 schools during your school life. Look, tell us that wonderful story about winning a public speaking competition.
Yeah, you know, the culture I come from, I always hesitate to generalize, and yet there is something to be said for the truth of a culture, and the place that I'm from, it's a German Catholic, very stoic, rural Midwestern place where there's plenty of love, but it's a quiet love, and there's not a lot of pats on the back going around. And so for that reason, the accolades that I was able to access in the school system meant the world to me, because it was kind of the only place where a kid whose family can't afford summer camp or piano lessons or trips to the public swimming pool, the school was the only place that I was going to intersect with society and potentially be validated for aspects of myself that my family did not have the resources or maybe understanding to validate. And so when I was in fifth grade, it was announced there would be this massive speaking contest, and I had never given a speech in my life, but I thought, this sounds like something where people are going to have to listen to what I have to say. Sign me up. I put my whole heart into it, and I ended up winning. And moments like that, I think, for me as a kid were, maybe even more transformative than they would have been for a more privileged child, because it's sort of like when you're thirsty for water, how delicious, more delicious that sip is, you know?
Sarah, I left school at 15. There was no thought of going to university. How the hell did you get to the University of Kansas?
As a kid, so I was a teenager in the 90s when those kind of decisions would have been made, and I think that by then that was sort of at the peak cultural moment here, where it was just a very democratic, in theory, push for any kid who could access it to go to college. That had not always been the case as far as gender lines or racial lines or class lines. But I was definitely told by my public school teachers, you can be anything that you want. Now, that's a dangerous claim to make, and it isn't actually probably true, but it sounded good to me, and so I understood that if I wanted to have a life where I didn't have to bust my body, then it was going to be my mind that I would rely on for a paycheck, and that involved this thing called college. So I very strategically, just on kind of like what I describe in the book as a warpath of accomplishment, set out to make sure I got straight A's, the highest marks in our school system, and so that I would be able to be eligible for and receive scholarships to fund a state university, which I would not have afforded otherwise.
How did the family feel about you making it to university?
My family, one of the beauties of their dysfunction is that they never claimed to they never presumed to tell me what I ought to do with my life. There is a real humility in their recognition of the ways that our family, like any family, is broken. But I find that in some families there is this pretense of perfection. We never had that, and thank God, because my parents and grandparents just were like, well, she seems to have some good ideas about what to do with her life. Let her go at it. And they neither discouraged me nor necessarily encouraged. And I think that was they had no framework to understand something like a college campus or the career that I have now as a journalist. And so while there was, I think, pride in what they sensed as an accomplishment, they also didn't, claim that they knew anything about it. So it certainly was not any sort of direct involvement or championing, but just, an acceptance of whatever I did and a respect for me as a young person that I'm pretty grateful for.
Let's jump to now. We've been talking about the voter registration issues in the U.S., and I guess they apply in Kansas?
Yes. Our current Secretary of State has been recently found in contempt of a federal court for failing to follow their orders to basically reverse his unconstitutional efforts at voter suppression. So over the course of 3 years under his tenure, 31 to 35,000 legal voters in Kansas were kept off of the rolls. And these are during years of quite pivotal elections. And so this what's going on right now as we lead up to the midterms in my state and in many states across the country has really amounted to not so much focusing on trying to convince the other side to come to our side and vote the way that we think, but rather to protect the integrity of the vote in our election system, to be hypervigilant about domestic meddling with our votes, and to reach out to and engage people who have previously not been enfranchised. So that's definitely where the spirit is right now.
Sarah, any chance of Kansas going Democrat?
I do believe there is a chance, and it wasn't so long ago. The architect of our Affordable Care Act, which is our, largely privatized but publicly subsidized medical healthcare system here, the architect of that under the Obama administration is our former Democratic governor, who just about a decade ago, Kathleen Sebelius, was a Democrat in charge of this state. So, I think we sometimes have kind of short memory with when we talk about politics, and when Kansas is described as a deep red state, I think to myself, the same people that voted her in are still here. And so I do think there's a chance. This is a very different moment than a decade ago, of course, but my biases are such that my hope springs eternal in that direction.
Well, I'm going to vote for Sarah Smarsh, author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Philip, and thanks for your vote.
And that book, incidentally, is published by our friends at Scribe.